Now, just a few months ago, many here at Living Hope considered the question, am I a fan or a follower of Jesus? Now, fans do a lot to show their passion or identification for something. They listen, they watch, and they cheer. They buy t-shirts and wear hats. They stay up late and go to movies, as I was in line around midnight last Thursday to see The Hobbit. They read books and learn lots of information. Now, fans of Jesus go to church, pray, put bumper stickers on their cars, and say, "Praise the Lord," every now and then. But is their real life change? Are we really following Jesus to the extent of giving him total control or keeping him at a distance like a fan of Jesus would? Evidence that there are more fans in church, not necessarily this church, but in the church in America, that there are more fans and followers is a reality that believers in Jesus live no different in many cases than unbelievers do, just as likely to lie, to steal, or commit adultery. But what I want us to consider this morning is, particularly for those who went through that not a fan study, are you continuing to follow in the way you were challenged and convicted to? Are you maintaining the course to grow deeper into Jesus? Because we know how that goes, right? You go through a study, things are revealed, you learn something, you're convicted, you know, Jesus brings you a place of just change and transformation, and then it just gets old. It gets familiar. Things start being laid down by the wayside, and we don't follow through on what we had originally committed ourselves to. And for those of you who didn't go through the study, let me ask you, are you a fan? Are you a follower of Jesus? Do you just applaud Jesus? You like him? But stay away. You can have portions of me. I'll let you in, maybe 10%, 20% of my life. But for the most part, I am the Lord of my life. I dictate what I do. I determine the course of where I go. So am I a fan or am I a follower of Jesus? I mean, when was the last time the Christian life cost you something? That was a question that came up in the Not a Fan study that really challenged me. When was the last time my commitment to Christ, my Christian life, cost me something? Now, I don't mean money, but it does mean time. It does mean attention. When was the last time I really intentionally sanctified time to spend time with God, to build my relationship with him? You know, is my experience of Christianity just a Sunday morning thing? Is it something that I do for an hour and a half on Sunday, and then the rest of the week is mine? I've given God his time? See, we're completely misunderstanding God's purpose in our life if that's the way we perceive his activity. That he wants all of us. Now, he doesn't want all of us just so we give and we sacrifice and we deny ourselves and we pick up our cross. He wants all of us so he can bless, so he can provide, so he can fill, so he can transform, so he can forgive, that he can renew. But if we are guarding ourselves, if we're keeping ourselves from him, again, creating that safe distance that's comfortable for us, we will not be experiencing what God intends for us. Now, this question and challenge comes up because we find ourselves this morning in a passage in Matthew 8 that the Not a Fan study covered. You'll see it if you turn to Matthew 8:14. Now, as we've been working our way through the book of Matthew, we've seen that chapters 8 and 9 are really revelations of Jesus' miracles, some of the powerful things that Jesus accomplished. And I think Matthew is assembling them on purpose, showing Jesus' character, his care, the way he reaches out to people, but also showing the breadth of his power. I think he wants to wow us. He wants us to look at these miracles and say, wow, there's nothing this guy can't do. And as we see that, then we give our hearts more to Jesus. And I think because of that, he puts in the midst of these miracles, these discipleship interactions. These interactions with people that kind of bring up questions of like, what are you doing with Jesus? What are you doing with the Jesus that's doing these miracles? Again, is it just, yay, Jesus, you're really cool. You heal this guy, you heal from a distance, you're compassionate over here, you're calming the sea, you're really neat. So let's say yes, yay for Jesus. But the question is Jesus changing our lives? Are we letting him change our lives? And so read with me or follow as I read Matthew 8, verses 18 through 22. When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus replied, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Another disciple said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." Now, if you were in the Not a Fan study, if you read the book or saw the videos, whatever, do you remember this? Do you remember this passage? Now, in the Not a Fan study, he was looking at Luke's rendition of this event, of this account in Jesus' life. In Luke, there are actually three interactions that Jesus has, but ultimately here in Matthew is two. So we'll kind of delve into them in terms of what is being communicated here. So we see the scribe coming up to Jesus and asking him this question. Now, it's not hard to imagine that this scribe has heard Jesus preach. You know, if there was anyone who would be around for the Sermon on the Mount and be drinking it in terms of just experiencing Jesus' insight, his authority, the passion with which he taught, saying, yeah, well, boy, there's something different about this guy. Then after hearing the Sermon on the Mount and seeing these miracles and the way Jesus acts and his compassion, bringing him to this place of, wait a minute, when I see you and all you are, Jesus, yeah, I'll go anywhere with you. I'll follow you anywhere. You know, it was very common at that time for students of the law, those who sought to know God, to align themselves with other teachers, to find a rabbi, to find a Pharisee, to find someone who was more schooled and more learned than them, and they would then be their disciple. They would then follow them in terms of their learning. So Jesus doesn't necessarily, Sarah, say, no, I don't want you, you don't have enough. But what he's saying to this person is, do you understand what you're following? See, you in your understanding, in your mind, scribe, you're thinking that this is going to be a learning experience for you. That you're going to follow me, you're going to come, and you're going to know more about the scriptures. And Jesus said, you know something? My way is more than just learning. It's about life. It's about what condition you find yourself in. It's the circumstances you're in because of the fact that you're putting yourself out there for the sake of people that put you in places that aren't always comfortable. And look at what he says here. It's just for those of us who like the grit and the grit, like, yeah, give me a tough task. Yeah, let me live in the woods and I'll eat grass and, you know, scratch my back with tree bark and all that. I'll be able to live on my own. I don't need the comfort of home. Some of us like that, right? Well, that's what Jesus is saying here. You know, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to raise and lay his head. You know, that tough, but he's not just being a tough guy here. He's just expressing a reality that, you know something, I'm not here to establish a permanent residence. I'm not going to build a nice home. It's not going to be a Taj Mahal. I'm here for the sake of people. I'm going to go from place to place to place to place. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus didn't have a bed to lay in. You know, again, we saw when he's in Capernaum, he's probably living at Peter's house or whatever the modern comforts of a fairly, you know, prosperous Jewish person would get or what a fisherman would live in. You know, Jesus would experience that. But he wasn't saying, boy, it's really nice at your house here, Peter, so I'm going to stay here. No, it's just when I'm here, I'm here. But then when I'm traveling around, wherever God now calls me, whatever place I find myself in, then I'm taking from that situation whatever God offers and whatever he provides. And so therefore, are you willing to go there with me? See, when you say you'll follow me anywhere, I need to be honest with you about what that means. See, that's something we can know about Jesus, is that when we come to Jesus and we give our lives to Him, He's going to be honest about what the task is. And it's going to be hard. There's going to be challenges. There's going to be a place where your body is not comfortable, where you're not going to be getting the things that you necessarily want. I mean, we want to have a place to lay our heads. We want a place that's comfortable. And Jesus is saying that's not necessarily what is going on here. So basically, you know, the challenge to us, the challenge to the scribe is, are you still willing to follow? I mean, are you just caught up in the emotion of this, of your experience? You know, you've heard the teaching, you've seen the miracles. Now, wow, I'll follow. No, you have to think about that. You have to count the cost. How much are you going to give in order to follow Jesus? Now, ultimately, what Jesus' words in addition to this would be, you'll still receive all the benefits as well. You know, it's not just the, you have no place to lay your head, but as you have no place to lay your head, as you won't have the things of earth, you will have the things of heaven. You will have spiritual power. You'll have relationship with God. You'll have a sense that you're living in a plan that God has designed you for. And so ultimately, it's a question of what are we willing to give in order to get the things that are more important and substantive? See, it's a question of what we value oftentimes about whether we're a fan or a follower of Jesus. See, when we follow Jesus, there are great benefits we receive. It's an exciting life that God is calling us to. For you and me as a human being to have an opportunity to have divine power flow through us, there's no better experience in all of the world. No drug or alcohol or situation would ever be able to come up with the experience of what it's like as a human being to experience divine power flowing through me. But that's what God offers. But sometimes in terms of the earth, in terms of the world, you've got no place to lay your head. That it's not going to be about satisfying the flesh. It's going to be about living in the power and influence of the Spirit. I think the biggest thing we lose is pride, self-will, and self-orientation. And so the question is, are you up for the challenge if this is what following Christ brings? Now, another thing that is going on here in the terms of this passage is this is the first time in Matthew that Jesus uses this term, Son of Man, for himself. And I think it's very purposeful why Jesus uses this term at this point. Basically, the reference or the title is used in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. And if you want to turn there, Mike is going to bring it up on the screen. But if you can turn to Daniel chapter 7, this is where we find this term, Son of Man. And basically, see, I got there faster, Daniel, see, man is always better than computers. Just realize that. 7:13, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Now let me just give you a background of these verses. Basically in Daniel 7, Daniel is woken up and he's given a vision of these four beasts. And these beasts, it's a bear, it's a lion, it's different, it's various different things. And so after these beasts kind of act out what their activity is going to be, devouring and destroying and all these different things, there is now a vision of the Ancient Days in the midst of that darkness breaking through with his light and his glory and his power. And ultimately, he's vanquishing all these beasts and their kingdoms and what they represent. And now, as the Ancient of Days sits on his throne, then what happens is the Son of Man comes and approaches the Ancient of Days. And now, ultimately, the Ancient of Days, in terms of the kingdom that he's established, is now talking to the Son of Man, saying, now you have dominion. Now you have power. This is one who's like a person. Now, what makes him like a person? Because he's just not a person. He's also God. And that's what Jesus is. He's the son of, he's like a son of man because ultimately that's not all he is. He's something more than that. But I think this title in terms of what Jesus is alluding to and calling himself is very significant in terms of just appreciating again who Jesus is. So again, it's used here in Daniel 7 in terms of an apocalyptic vision of what God is going to accomplish in terms of the end, in terms of consummating history and bringing everything to a place of truth and justice and righteousness. And the Son of Man is involved in that, in terms of the Ancient of Days communicating something to him. And so therefore, for the Jewish people, when they hear this term Son of Man, that's what they would think of. They would think of Daniel chapter 7. Now, some interesting facts about this title, Son of Man. It is used 81 times in the Gospels, 69 in the Synoptics. In other words, 69 times in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In every instance, it is found either on Jesus' lips or in two instances on those quoting Jesus. Very significant point that in every instance, it's Jesus calling himself this. And so therefore, when we think of it, when you think about the things that Jesus chose to call himself, in some ways that's the most significant thing Jesus could be called, right? See, it's not so much what other people call him, but what does he call himself? Who does Jesus understand himself to be? And so ultimately, his favorite title for himself is Son of Man. Now, I think it's very significant that Jesus chooses this title for himself more consistently. Because when we understand that Jesus is the Son of God and Son of Man, which title would you prefer to proclaim about yourself? And we'd go around saying, look, I'm the Son of God, I'm the Son of God. See, the Son of God wouldn't do that. The Son of God would have known the microphone was there and he wouldn't step on the... But in other words, we would take the term that's most powerful, that has the most identification, the most glory involved. So the fact that Jesus, more consistently for himself, calls himself a Son of Man, it ultimately means that he more wants to communicate his identification with us than his power over us. Now, there are three different themes under which the term Son of Man is used. It's either used for this apocalyptic Son of Man who comes at the end of the age, like in Daniel 7, or reminiscing about that. It's either used also in terms of the suffering and dying Son of Man, and then the earthly Son of Man engaged in a number of present ministries, like here in Matthew 8. Now, I like what D.A. Carson says about this term, that this term Son of Man, and Jesus using it, both reveals and conceals. In other words, that even though you can say some things about what the Son of Man is, there's actually a lot of scholarly interpretation in terms of just what this term means. And what D.A. Carson comes to the conclusion of is, like, Jesus might have intended that confusion. You know, in the sense that Jesus didn't always want to reveal everything about himself, but wanted people to seek. That if he made it too easy for people, that's just not the way he acted. He actually put some things before people to encourage their investigation, to cause them to question, so they then, by their will, would come to him. So therefore, he uses this somewhat vague term that reveals part of who he is, but also conceals who he is. Like I said, D.A. Carson feels like, and I would agree, that that's why Jesus uses it. But now think about what this term means for Jesus to identify himself with. Like, what is he trying to communicate? Certainly it does affirm that Jesus understood that he is the Messiah in terms of what Daniel 7 reveals. You know, and again, it's important for Jesus. It's not enough for us to go to Jesus and say, Jesus, you're the Messiah. Jesus himself has to identify himself as the Messiah first in order for us to call him that. So the fact that Jesus understood in using this term, yes, when you have that vision of that person being presented to the Ancient of Days, that's me, one that's like a Son of Man. and I will fulfill the ages. I will come in the end. I will make everything right. And so part of that is that messianic vision that he's identifying with just by using that term. I think that term, in terms of him using it, is his identification with human beings, both joining them and representing them. The fact that Jesus recognizes that he has taken on finite creation. I mean, one of the mysteries of the ages is how can Jesus be God and man? It's something that only God could accomplish. That it would be fair for Jesus to say, I am God, I am divine, I am the Son of God. But on the other hand, for Jesus to say, I am human, I am finite, I am limited in terms of my physical being. And that is the incarnational aspect of who Jesus is, the complexity of who Jesus is. And if you really start thinking about it now, how does Jesus engage with himself? Like, how does now Jesus as a Son of Man act and work and do and not be the Son of God? To have that divine presence in his life, but then not operate in it? That's called a kenosis of Christ, but that's another different subject. But basically, in calling himself the Son of Man, he's identifying with us. You know, in some ways, when we ask that question, where is God when human tragedy happens? Where was God when this madman was shooting the kids in Connecticut? Where was he in 9/11? He is with us. He is present, trying to convict, trying to change, trying to spread good in the midst of evil. If you think for a second that he's not in the hearts of those people doing that evil, saying, stop, don't do, this is wrong, this is dark, or all their lives trying to, again, convict them of sin, convict them of righteousness, and convict them of, what's that third thing in John 16? In other words, the Spirit is there trying to reach out to the world. But on the other hand, he's there with the victims. He's there with the crying children. He's there with the kids in the classroom, protecting and comforting and consoling. He's there now with the answer in terms of, now what do we do with this? How do we understand this? Who's the arbiter in terms of justice? In terms of what's right and wrong in this situation? And then who do we go to for forgiveness? To find a forgiveness that goes beyond our capacity to forgive, because ultimately when that evil is done and we are not able to forgive that person who does it, now that lack of forgiveness corrupts our soul and damages us. And so where is God? God is there surrounding every aspect of tragedy, being and doing everything he absolutely can. But what what we can know is there are some things that God won't do. God will not stop the gun. God will not let the bullets fly. It's just evident that he doesn't do that. But that doesn't mean just because he doesn't stop evil, doesn't mean he doesn't care about it, he's disengaged, or he's somehow confused, or he's absent. Rather, he is there, surrounding the situation with everything that he can do. But see, this title of Son of Man shows God's intent to be there. See, the minute Jesus comes to this earth and says, I am with you, I am one of you. This is God's intent to reach into the world and join you in terms of your misery, join you in terms of your suffering, even to the extent that he's saying the Son of Man has no place to lie his head, that I'm not even going to use the fact that I'm the Son of Man to promote my position for wealth and for glory here on earth, that I'm going to sacrifice and I'm going to suffer. I'm not here to glean the benefits of the world. I'm here to reveal another world, another perspective, another power, another provision. But in order for me to do that, I've become one of you. And that's God's mercy. That's God's compassion. That is showing God's heart that when we're dealing with suffering, we're dealing with tragedy, we're dealing with things that we can't understand, God is present there with us to help us understand. That there's always a place, like I prayed, to be still and know that God is God. That God has a way, that God has a plan, that God has a purpose. No, God does not purpose evil. God does not make bad people do bad things, but he presses his goodness in spite of the evil. And that's where we have to understand, we are part of that. We as believers are part of the good that God is trying to press into the world. And sometimes the reason why the world is the way it is, because you know something? We have not been the ambassadors that God intends for us to be. We have not been the followers he intends. When the world looks at us and says, wait a minute, you act the same way we do? How do you show me you have surpassing power? You have surpassing influence? How can you tell me you represent God or represent something better when you go to the same resources I go to? That you drink the same way I drink? You lie the way I lie? You steal the way I leave? You visit the websites that I've... All the different things that we do that ultimately it doesn't reflect Jesus. So now we go into the world, and we're the ambassadors. We're supposed to be this light, and the darkness needs to see it to be changed, but the darkness doesn't see it, so the darkness doesn't change. You know, I wonder, you know, the report of this individual says, you know, yeah, we always knew that he was kind of a crazy man. You know, these people are always aloof. There are all these, well, who are the people that know they're aloof and they're not doing something about it? Who's a person that sees that guy wandering around and not having any friends and doesn't come along and befriend them? Where is the 5 and 10 years that if someone made a difference and invested in that young man, he wouldn't be doing what he's doing today? So we just can't... divest ourselves of the responsibility we have in this. But to know that, because we just automatically connect, because God didn't stop the evil, it means he's not present. And don't fall into that trap. Because you know, it's fair for you to go to God and ask him. You complain, be mad. Again, God will accept that. But what I know is that's just when you look at the way God acts, that's not the way he acts. Now, again, you can question him on that. You can have a problem with that. But again, you know, when you're, there's only so far you're arguing with God can go. Because you have to understand, when you argue with God and say, God, why didn't you do it this way? Okay, well, I created you. I spoke things into being. You know, I did those 10 plagues things. I parted the Red Sea. I sent Jesus. He you know, did miraculous things, fed 5,000 people, raised the dead, healed the blind, died on a cross, was raised. I offered you salvation. So how much do you want to question me? You know, you go to the book of Job. Job, you sit and you listen. I'll tell you what's up. Were you there when I formed the earth? Were you there when I spoke this into creation? See, there's a place for us to as believers to say, you know, God, I recognize who you are, and see, you are not distinct. You are not separate from me. You are not away from me. In everything you have shown, you are with me. What a great place for us to be in terms of just this whole idea of where is God when trapped. He's the Son of Man. That when Jesus said, you know something, what do I want to leave you with? What do I want you to be thinking of me about? Yeah, that I'm the Son of Man. Yeah, I'm the Son of God, and we can get to that. I'm divine. But you have to know first and foremost that I am with you, that I identify with you. I represent you. Then in the sense that Jesus, as the one who would now die for our sins, hang on the cross, have our sins placed before him, or on him rather, he is before God representing us. The only way Jesus can offer that salvation is if he is human, if he is the Son of Man. I think the third thing that he's doing when he says the Son of Man, he's identifying with frailty and eventually dying because of it. See, it's only as a son. You can't kill the Son of God. The Son of God cannot be nailed to a cross. the Son of Man can be. And so that's why we have this. When we talk about how Jesus communicates, uses this title 81 times in the Gospels, when he's talking about himself, always on his lips, no one else ever calls Jesus the Son of Man. Jesus calls himself this. It makes sense that the apocalyptic vision talks about this completion and this consummation of how he, as a representative of humanity, will bring things to a conclusion in the end. But on the other hand, he will suffer. He will die for us. But then he also uses it in the context of just, hey, I'm here ministering to people. I mean, the Son of Man doesn't have a place to lay his head because I care more about people than I do things. And that's why he's saying what he's saying. Now, as we continue in Matthew, we'll see how the Son of Man unfolds. But let's, just to complete the passage we're in, this second man who talks here, just talking about burying his father, right? Another disciple said to me in verse 21, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. But Jesus told him, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. There's actually mixed opinion in terms of explaining Jesus' answer here. On one hand, there are those, and this is what was communicated in the Not a Fan study, is that when this man said, can I go and bury my father, this really was an elongated process. That he was ultimately coming to Jesus saying, I want to follow you, but really I'd rather want to do that 2 years from now. Because part of the way you can interpret bury your father is I'm going to care for him until he dies. And there's one way to explain it that way. There's one way to think of it in terms of this man saying he wants to follow, but he's really looking for an excuse why he won't. Because he's going to take a time frame and not follow. But there's another way to look at it, and that is the fact that even if this man was looking for a time frame to care for his father, if you look at the Old Testament, that's what the Old Testament would have you do. Certainly when it came to burying your parents, the right thing for you to do is to bury your parents. The right thing for you to do is to care for your parents in terms of them coming to their end and so on and so forth. And so the other way of looking at this is that Jesus is just using hyperbole. That Jesus is using an extreme case just to give us another way to look at it. Again, Jesus is challenging in a place that we wouldn't expect him to challenge. But when it comes to every aspect of life, we need to think of it differently in terms of recognizing Jesus as Lord. In other words, the case being is that if you did want to go and spend time with your father to care for him, if you wanted to go and spend time with your father to bury him, and God said no, what would you then do? See, Jesus is declaring in this hyperbole that he is the Lord of all. That you don't come to him and say, hey, I'm going to go bury my father. No, you go bury your father when I tell you to go bury your father. That you should only bury your father or take time with him if God tells you to do that. You know, and so therefore, this really, this falls in the category of the things that Jesus said that he just says in an extreme way. When Jesus says, you know, when your eye offends you, go pluck it out. We know that Jesus does not mean that literally. Jesus does not want us to go pluck our eyes out. When he says, whoever loves me must hate their father, hate their mother, hate their children, hate everyone, you know, all those hates. Because if you love God, God doesn't mean, oh, well, great. You mean if I love God, I can hate people? Bonus. You know, some of us would be happy. Yeah, I've got a reason to hate my name. Yeah, that's what I'm looking. He doesn't mean that. But it's an extreme where he's saying, you know, your love for God should be so great that it almost seems like you hate your father. Because in comparison, in a human way of understanding it, the greatness of your love and the love you have your father, your love should feel like hate because your love for God is that great. And that's what he's saying. That's what he's saying here. Then when it comes to you now, I want to follow you, but I want to go over here. Wait. If you're saying I want to follow you, you don't then tell me directions about what you want to do. Following me is following me and letting me tell you what to do. And you know something? I think when it comes to these hyperbole that Jesus uses, the fact that he gives us hard statements, I think that we need that. I think in some ways we as human beings need to just sometimes be told, you know something? The way you think about it is wrong. This is the truth. This is what's right. This is the way you go. That again, you don't come to me and tell me what to do. If I'm the Lord, if I'm God, I tell you what to do. And I think on the other hand, I think not only do we need it, I think we want it. I think there's part of us as human beings that understand, you know something? If something is valuable, it's going to require sacrifice. If something's important, I have to give myself to it. And so when Jesus in both these ways really pushes us to an extreme and says, yeah, are you a fan or are you a follower? Are you really committed to my cause or are you really more committed to yourself and you want me to support that? Because you know something, that's not the way I roll. That's not the way I operate. If you want to come to me as a follower, then you know something, it's all or nothing. That's what God is calling us to in terms of following him as our Lord, following him in terms of his plan. Again, being his disciples. You know, I think there is a place, as I've said it before, there is a place of believing that is about grace. I think you can be a believer and really be saved and have a covenant with God, and your life won't reflect that. That there's a growing process for you to grow into. But again, when we get to that point where we say, now, God, I'm a follower of Jesus, that's when Jesus says, well, you know something? Put that foolishness aside. Stop living for yourself then if you're going to live for me. Let's bow our heads and let's just have Mike come forward. And he's going to play a song that kind of just introduces this time of prayer. And sorry I've gone a little longer than I would have wanted to, but let's take this time to just pray for our nation, pray for these families affected in Connecticut.
Covers all the land. Sounds of day are gone, but love is all around you now, and will be till the dawn. So there's no need to be afraid. The whole night through, 'cause God has made a promise, child, that he'll take care of you. Stars shine on your windowsill, the moon shines through the trees, angels by your bed tonight shine where no one sees. All that you've been dreaming of awaits you when you rise. So with the peace that Jesus brings, close your sleep.